Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on China and the final war for resources right after this message. You know, in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. Public business is conducted in commercial paper. Commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, debt, and usury. Well, back in 1965, Congress told us that there is no difference in the value of gold and silver coin and clad coin or currency. And that's very true when you're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in the purchasing power of gold over paper, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper that isn't due on the gold. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. Those politicians knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order for their subjection of a free people of the United States, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin, to take away the people's right to property and to destroy their property rights. And they did just that under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abrogation or the abolition of all right to property and land. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights and duties, our capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. This business school is now on compact disc for adult homeschoolers. For more information about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge. You can call and order yours right now. The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email machine on the website and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Well, in 1999, Chinese generals, Chinese military analysts, wrote a paper called Unrestricted War, China's Master Plan to Destroy America. Two Chinese military strategists stated in the document that in order for China to become a dominant global power over the United States, the final war over resources must be successfully concluded. And though this could be easily blown off as just more hype from the People's Liberation Army, a closer look at the facts shows us that the United States is in a very vulnerable position on a number of fronts with China, and so with that is the United States dollar. Now, as long-time readers of the OI News Report know, that the resurgence of gold and the fall of the dollar have a multiple factor working together. Going forward into 2005, China's final war for resources will be a key factor in the further depreciation of the greenback. The United States government has been keeping a lid on the brewing problems with China because of the delicate situation which has the Chinese central bank holding billions in U.S. dollars and treasury bonds which Washington fears that they might sell. China has been instrumental in helping the United States government bankroll its deficit, and consequently, this reliance on the Chinese to support the United States debt has the government up against a rock and hard spot. This problem is made worse each day by the huge trade imbalance favoring the Chinese. The U.S. dollar reserves of China's central bank soared 271% to $450 billion from April of 2000 until April of 2004. And while they have been filling their coffers with greenbacks, their balance of trade with the United States is also building. The trade deficit with China last year was a record $124 billion, and this year it has increased by 28% over last year. Meanwhile, the United States is financing its ever-ballooning budget deficit, which is projected officially to be $521 billion in 2004. Zhu Min, the general manager and advisor to the president for the Bank of China, was quoted in the China Daily earlier this year saying that the United States is benefiting from China, using its trade surplus to buy United States Treasury paper as a reserve currency, along with other Asian nations. But in the long run, this is not sustainable. China will focus more and more on domestic demand, which is growing fast. Then we won't be able to finance the United States deficit. And now that's what's happening. China is reportedly selling off their hoard of U.S. dollars to help build up their much-needed infrastructure and spend heavily to secure global resources. A United Nations report points out that China's recent prosperity has raised the living standard of 160 million Chinese who once existed in poverty. Behind them are another 800 million Chinese who are awaiting their turn to live a life once thought unattainable in China. The demand of goods and services from this group means an even greater global demand for the world's dwindling natural resources. The desire of China to tie up resources has been evidenced by China Min Metals Corporation, who had been in exclusive talks with Noranda, one of Canada's largest mining companies, in an attempt to buy the company for an estimated $7 billion. There was tremendous opposition to this plan, however. Canadians argued that the Chinese government's strategic interest in securing mineral supplies and its management method could be contrary to the interests of Noranda, its work in agreement to buy oil and gas, but also to develop Iran's Yadavarian oil field. And after this field is developed, Iran will export 150,000 barrels of crude oil per day to China. This agreement has been valued at $70 billion. China's demand for oil outpaced its supply capabilities in 1993. China is now the world's third largest importer of crude oil after the United States and Japan, and their demand is growing daily. From January to October, China imported 99.6 million tons of crude oil, exceeding the 91 million tons imported in the whole of 2003. Or so say the reports quoting the General Administration of Customs. Imports of crude oil in 2004 are expected to reach 120 million tons, the second largest in the world, after the United States. Demand for electricity is also on the rise in China, and despite record production of coal and a 15% rise in power generation over the first 10 months of this year. Dozens of Chinese cities suffered brownouts during the past summer, and this winter it looks like many will be left without heat for extended periods. The China Daily reports that Beijing has only 50% of the coal that it needs this winter, and while Jilin has stores of 40%, half the level that it had at this time last year. So the multi-billion dollar question is, what happens when China starts selling U.S. dollars to help expand their infrastructure and to secure their need for natural resources? Well, you're and a 15% rise in power generation over the first 10 months of this year. Dozens of Chinese cities suffered brownouts during the past summer, and this winter it looks like many will be left without heat for extended periods. The China Daily reports that Beijing has only 50% of the coal that it needs this winter, and while Jilin has stores of 40%, half the level that it had at this time last year. So the multi-billion dollar question is, what happens when China starts selling U.S. dollars to help expand their infrastructure and to secure their need for natural resources? Well, interest rates go up, the dollar goes down, and gold takes flight upwards, not to mention upward pressure on oil, gas, coal, copper, and other key commodity prices. The implications of this fact are staggering, and demand for commodities will be overwhelming. Insightful investors who can see this trend and position themselves now in growth-oriented equities, holding gold, oil, copper, and other key commodities, will be sitting pretty if a few years go by and will have weathered the U.S. dollar collapse better than most. Now, this is the greatest threat to the U.S. economy right now, and yet it's hardly ever mentioned by the mainstream media. Given the strong economic growth of China and the uncertain purse strings that it holds on U.S. dollars and treasury bonds, I can't help but wonder how this might tie in with their aggressive militaristic actions. Last week, for example, a Chinese nuclear-powered submarine cruised into Japanese territorial waters in an apparent test of Japan's will to enforce its own sovereignty. At stake here are underwater natural gas riches in the East China Sea, very close to the border of Japan's economic zone. The government of Japan is worried that China may try and tap into gas pools within their jurisdiction. One fact that doesn't sit well with the Bush administration is that U.S. intelligence reports claim China's military provided training to both the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. Though U.S. officials are at a loss to explain why the Chinese provided this training, some analysts believe that it was an attempt to gain influence over these terrorist groups. Now, given China's need for commodities, its human rights offenses, and their hawkish military actions, one must wonder if the Chinese government really has a detrimental agenda for America. The writings of the People's Liberation Army colonels and their generals state that the aggressor nation must adjust its own financial strategy, use currency revaluation or devaluation as primary weapons, and to combine means such as getting the upper hand in public opinion and changing the rules sufficiently to make financial turbulence and economic crisis appear in the targeted country or area, weakening its overall power, including its military strength. Whether it be the intrusions of hackers, a major explosion at the World Trade Center, support the premise that in order to protect yourself, diversification into gold, oil, and other key commodities makes good sense, not only to profit, but to help keep your wealth intact in the face of a depreciating dollar. On the heels of that story is a piece by Edgar J. Steele called The Coming Balkanization of America. With the breakup of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union has become a conglomerate of Balkan states. That's what we saw in Yugoslavia. Will that happen in the United States of America? Well, in the Soviet Union, they had 161 distinct nationalities or ethnic groups. The Soviet Union was an integrated society. Integration was a prohibition by God Almighty, which manifested itself first in Genesis chapter 10 or 11 at the Tower of Babel, when God personally separated the nations and ethnic groups of the world and put them in their own habitations. Primarily, the white Anglo-Saxons of Western Europe have been the primary violators of this statute, this law, this rule or regulation set in motion by God some 4,000 years ago. It's the Anglo-Saxons that have been at the forefront of integration. Integration as a policy, integration in marriage, integration in economies, integration in military, NATO, the United States of Europe. And if you'll take a look at the 20 million Muslims now living in Europe, what they were unable to accomplish in the Middle Ages through military means, they have now accomplished through totally peaceful means by providing labor to the Europeans, and now have a toehold in America. The Muslims have 7 million in this country. That's not the whole iceberg. That's only the tip of the iceberg. You have 25 million, or 25% of our population, I should say, which are black or Hispanic. And then there's another small percentage. It now totals about 32% of our population is non-white. We have brought in a number of ethnic and national groups, thinking that this was the logical, systematic methodology of a burgeoning society, an industrial society, an industrial power worldwide. It's been going on for about 100 years in the United States. So Edgar Steele wrote an article called The Coming Balkanization of America that fits in with Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. Listen to what he has to say. He says, we must understand clearly and firmly that the dominant authorities not only do nothing to conserve what most of us regard as our traditional way of life, but they actually seek its destruction. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate or deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground. They want rain without thunder or lightning. Now, I've heard it said that anybody with a globe and a bottle of whiskey can be a geopolitician. Though I drink very little these days, I do own a globe. So let's test that thesis. My best take on how things might go in America when the dominoes start falling. The battle lines will be drawn along what will be perceived to be defensible borders, coincident with natural impediments like rivers and mountain ranges. The lines will be drawn racially at first. A great deal depends upon whether America's metropolitan areas are left intact. Aztlan, A-Z-T-L-A-N, will become a reality in those days, and there is not a thing that anybody can do about it. In truth, there is very little that could be done about it today. If the militant mestizos occupying the future territory of Aztlan wish to take it right now, they could. Judging strictly by current population makeup and the proximity to the Mexican border, Aztlan's borders will stretch from the Pacific coastline across northern California, bisecting Nevada and Utah. The southwestern portion of Colorado will be included along with much of Oklahoma and western Texas. Arizona and New Mexico will go entirely, of course. When reports of the carnage against non-Hispanic residents of Aztlan reached the rest of America with Latino populations, the reprisal killings and violence will precipitate a headlong dash for the new border by all Hispanics not already in Aztlan. Simultaneously, a similar scenario will be playing out in the Deep South, where blacks simply will be up an already simmering race war to a full boil. And I expect that border to enclose the already huge black populations of eastern Virginia and eastern North Carolina. All of South Carolina will go, and together with all but the far northern reaches of Georgia and Alabama. All of Mississippi and Louisiana will be included, together with eastern Texas, southeast Arkansas, and southwest Tennessee. For lack of a better term, I have dubbed this new region due to become a country unto itself. I call it New Africa. I see a strong possibility born of necessity for a Gulf Coast port of New America, dipping down through eastern Texas in a swath that encompasses both Dallas and Houston, thereby dividing Aztlan from New Africa. Florida will become a special case due to its large population of Cuban and Caribbean extraction. How it will shake out is anybody's guess, but it will end up being a white no-go zone. Of that, you can be sure. Buffer zones of varying widths naturally will arise along the de facto borders of Aztlan, New Africa, and what will become New America. These will be the only relatively safe areas for those who find themselves welcome on neither side of the new borders, as with mixed-race families. There will be outposts, strongholds, if you will, of blacks deep in what becomes white territory. Detroit, Michigan comes to mind as an example. What comes of them at first is anybody's guess, but eventually those people will migrate to New Africa. That is, if history is any guide. And you can see that going on in the country of Sudan today, which is black in the south and Arab in the north. If America undergoes change as a result of war, it likely will have been a part of World War III, and many of America's cities will have been reduced to rubble. Regardless, intact cities will become battle zones with the suspension of food deliveries particularly, and devolved to the control of street gangs. Populations will spread into the countryside, where refugee camps will be erected and where the street gangs will be met and destroyed as they emerge both desperate and hungry from the cities. You can read about this in Ezekiel chapter 6, verse 6, and chapter 2, verse 3. If America is not preemptively decapitated, it will have responded in kind, and national borders all around the world will shift. The Chinese will move into all of Southeast Asia, Indochina, and possibly Australia and New Zealand. China can be expected to swallow Japan whole and take most of Russia east of the Ural Mountain Range. Alaska possibly will be seized by the Chinese at first, given China's burgeoning demand for oil and the prospect of its salvation looming just over the rise beneath the northern slopes. China possibly even could establish a beachhold in the far west of Canada and the northwest tip of America, including Seattle, a region already home to a huge Asian population. And should this happen, expect general reprisals against those of Asian descent throughout what remains of America. They will of necessity flee to the far northwest. If a general war has taken place, Canada's capital will be laid waste as well, with the rest of Canada likely throwing its lot in with de facto white America. Eastern Canada, possibly, will choose to go its own way. South America and sub-Saharan Africa will sink into a morass of crime, revolution, genocide, and inter-tribal warfare, once free of their Western masters and overseers. Israel will be turned into a giant self-illuminated glass parking lot by the Arab states it has tormented for so long. And likely, it will take large portions of the Middle East with it as it goes down. A new Islam-based Muslim empire will arise from the ashes of the Middle East, stretching from India in the east to Turkey in the west, and from Kazakhstan in the north, well into northern Africa in the south. Internecine fighting will keep the Muslims occupied for centuries to come, just as had occurred for so many centuries in the past. Eastern Europe will erupt into regional wars. What with the removal of American and other Western influence, it will shake out eventually, as will America, along racial lines. Russia will become substantially smaller and be occupied with fortifying its borders, provided it is not laid waste as a part of a nuclear world at war. Russia's greatest immediate danger may well come from the nuclear arsenal of an Israel caught up in the throes of death, though Russia's long-term enemy will prove to be China, just as it will prove to be America's. India and Pakistan will devalue and devastate one another with their nuclear arsenals, just as they have threatened to do for so long. The northern reaches of Europe, Norway, Sweden, and Finland stand a chance of coming through unscathed, as do the alpine portions of Europe. Western European nations, which have become as racially mixed as America, will share America's fate, and for the same reasons. As America begins the long walk back from its own troubles, I foresee a schism arising between the Western and the Eastern portions as ideological differences manifest themselves. The big government control freak nature of many in the eastern portion of the United States, particularly the remaining Zionists, will prove intolerable to freewheeling and independent-minded Westerners. Depending upon how things progress, Jews in America could become the focus of a great deal of anger by people throughout the world, particularly in America, if they're seen as having been the source of the difficulties, and particularly a war that escapes the Middle East and then engulfs the entire world. And while I don't foresee a breakout of hostilities between the two regions in America, I do see there being a break of the sort that should have occurred in lieu of the American Civil War of the 1860s. This dividing line could well end up being in the vicinity of the Mississippi River, and there could be further splits as America continues to balkanize, such as the former Soviet Union, when it broke apart in the late 1980s. For lack of a better term, I have dubbed the far eastern portion of what will remain of America New Israel. The size of New Israel will depend inversely upon the degree of hostility to Jews and any requirement by New America that Jews be excluded strictly along racial lines. I do not foresee Americans actually expelling any who have attained American citizenship, nor do I advocate such expulsion. However, just as blacks and mestizos inevitably will concentrate themselves in those areas which they currently dominate, so will Jews concentrate into an area centering on what already has become New Tel Aviv, that's New York City. And because of the violent white overreaction to the murder of whites in Aztland and the New Africa, all blacks and mestizos will end up south of those borders, and all whites who don't head north will be killed. I don't foresee anything of that sort occurring with Jews, but they are likely to find themselves singularly unwelcome in what remains of white America. The region which is left, including portions of Canada, is what I think of as New America. New America will be bounded on the west by the Pacific Ocean, to the north by the far reaches of Canada's Yukon, to the east by New Israel, and to the south by Aztlan, New Africa, and the Gulf of Mexico, along the current Texas coastline. New America likely will stretch right through the Great Lakes region, incidentally, and encompass much of northern New England as well, giving it an Atlantic coastline. The people of Maine, New Hampshire, and northern Vermont are, for example, much more akin to those in the western United States than those in Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., and the Nexus. Eastern Canada could feel compelled to join as well, simply to ensure its self-preservation in a growing and hostile world. Thus, New America becomes pretty much a white European homeland with its borders imposed upon it by others. Only the presence of Jews may be problematic and by far may prove to be the single most difficult task confronting New America, even in the face of all of the chaos, death, and destruction caused by and on behalf of Zionists throughout the world. Now, this moral dilemma will prove so difficult, in fact, that I believe it likely to cause a further split of the eastern region, with the smaller portion going to those who demand ethnic purity by exclusion of all Jews. There are rumors of agents of the Israel Defense Force buying up huge swaths of land in southern Argentina, where monstrous sheep and cattle ranches have been on the market in recent years at rock-bottom prices. This makes me think that Israel has a fallback plan should it need to exit the Middle East altogether, and in the event that America also becomes inhospitable. Thus, it is possible that we may see Jews migrating to South America in huge numbers, but likely setting up a government that most American Jews would find intolerable. And while I cannot advocate forcing the outright expulsion of any American citizen, save those granted their franchise by virtue of their parents illegally entering America for the purpose of having one or more children born into citizenship, certainly I can support the idea of drawing boundary lines and requiring citizens to choose one side or the other so that different political structures can be erected in different states. New America. An idea whose time has come. So says Edgar J. Steele. I find many of Steele's essays somewhat interesting because they do, in fact, parallel Bible prophecy, particularly those prophecies aimed at Israel, those in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Western Europe, where the Israelite tribes have settled. All right, let's keep in mind that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or go to the webpage georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. While we're on the subject of the coming Balkanization of America and China, the final war for resources, keep in mind that carrying on spying, Russian agents are flooding the United Kingdom in revival of the intelligence Cold War. Russia has resumed Cold War levels of spying and intelligence gathering in Britain, so says senior Whitehall and security sources that have reported or told to The Independent. Among the spies are at least 32 Russian diplomats who are attempting to obtain secret information about the United Kingdom's military, technical, and political capabilities, according to authoritative sources. The spy network is also collecting information about opponents and critics of Vladimir Putin, the Russian president and former KGB officer who are exiled in Britain. A Whitehall source said that the level of espionage by the Russians in the United Kingdom is back to Cold War levels, and it is business as usual for the spies. M15, the counterintelligence agency, has warned David Blunkett, the Home Secretary, of the growing Russian spying activities, and it is concerned that funding for counterespionage work has been cut by half because resources have been reallocated to deal with Al-Qaeda. A confidential document, espionage threat, based on information provided by M15 and M16, the Secret Intelligence Service also reveals that Russian spies have been monitoring the movements of military aircraft in the United Kingdom. The classified paper, written by military intelligence earlier this year, said the agents were using the Internet to target military specialists with access to secret information. Several Russians have left Britain for alleged spying activities, although these departures have not been publicized to avoid a diplomatic rift with the Putin government. The buildup of the Russian spying capability in Britain and other European countries follows a policy change by President Putin since coming to power in the year 2000. Putin has replaced the powerful oligarchs of the Boris Yeltsin era with intelligence and military officers. The old Soviet culture of secrecy and foreign espionage has returned under the Putin regime. Britain is of great interest to Russia because of its strong ties to the United States and its influential role in NATO and its attitudes toward Iraq and Iran. In addition, the oligarchy and opponents of Putin living in the United Kingdom are prime targets for the Russian spy machine. These have included fallen oligarchs such as Boris Brezhilovsky, who has been in exile since 2000. In Britain, the Russian spying network is run by the SVR, that's the Foreign Intelligence Service, which partly replaced the old KGB and the GRU, the military intelligence organization. The SVR has about 18 officers in Britain, while the GRU has 14, all of whom have diplomatic status according to intelligence sources. They say officers each have dozens of informers and agents, and SVR is divided into three specialist fields, gaining intelligence on political issues, matters of security and technology, such as military and commercial secrets. The GRU, which is considered the most hardline and active of the agencies and which also runs dozens of agents, is involved in obtaining information on issues such as Britain's nuclear and military capabilities and American bases. M15 and M16 have given a series of warnings about the growth of Russian espionage to the Intelligence and Secret Security Committee, the group of MPs that oversees security matters in Great Britain. The committee's annual report, published earlier this year, said the threat from espionage did not disappear when the Cold War ended. Countries such as Russia and China still want to acquire both classified and material and technological information for exploitation by their own industry and their own military. It also noted that in 1999-2000, M15 allocated 20% of its budget to counter-espionage work, the bulk of which involved Russian or China spy activities. This has since dropped to 10%. Eliza Manningham Buller, the Director General of M15, told the committee that there is not less of it, that is espionage. We are going about and we are doing less work on it. We are being more selective about the priority cases, and it's something that I've discussed with the Home Secretary. I recently gave him a summary, and he is well aware that we are carrying some risk here. Now, the plan is to backfill when we can, but the problem is that the international counter-terrorist work is moving and expanding at a very rapid rate. Oleg Gordievsky, the double agent who served as head of the KGB at the Soviet embassy in London before he defected in 1985, said, "The strength of the KGB is that there are so many Russians living here and working for British companies. Each second Russian in a position of some importance is acting as an informer to the KGB. The information is about individuals who might be of interest to the Russian authorities and technology. They also want information about politicians. They have become much more active under Putin. Russia is under the foot of the KGB now." Alex Standish, the editor of Jane's Intelligence Digest, said that we're seeing a steady increase in the number of diplomats being posted in the United Kingdom. If you look at the profile of the individuals, you see a significant proportion of these people who are linked to the SVR. Putin is rapidly building up in intelligence systems that have been allowed to fall into decline under the Yeltsin era. A spokesman from the Russian embassy based at Kensington Palace Gardens in West London said that he had no comment. Now, Iraqi farmers used to save their own seed, and they were free. They were free of the innovation tradition now ruled illegal under the corporate-friendly patenting laws that are being enforced upon them by the United States military occupation. When you focus on the Global South and Grain Coalition Against Bayer CBG network, for generations, small farmers in Iraq operated in an essentially unregulated informal seed supply system. Farm and farmer saved seed, and the free innovation with an exchange of planting materials among farming and farming communities has long been the basis of agricultural practice in Iraq. This has been made illegal under the new law imposed by the American occupation force. The seeds that farmers are now allowed to plant, protected crop varieties brought into Iraq by transnational corporations in the name of agricultural reconstruction, will be the property of those corporations. While historically the Iraqi constitution prohibited private ownership of biological resources, the new United States imposed patent law introduces a system of monopoly rights over seeds that are imported into Iraq. Inserted into Iraq's previous patent law is a whole new chapter on plant variety. It's protection, PVP, that provides for the protection of new varieties of plants. PVP is an intellectual property right, an IPR, or a kind of patent for plant varieties, which gives an exclusive monopoly right on planting material to a plant breeder who claims to have discovered or developed a new variety. So the protection in PVP has nothing to do with conservation, but refers to safeguarding of the commercial interests of private breeders, usually large corporations such as Monsanto, claiming to have created these new plants. To qualify for PVP, plant varieties must comply with the standards of the UPOV Convention, which requires them to be new, distinct, uniform, and stable. Farmers' seeds cannot meet these criteria, making PVP protected seeds the exclusive domain of corporations. And the rights granted to plant breeders in this scheme include the exclusive right to produce, reproduce, sell, export, import, and store these protected varieties. These rights extend to harvested material, including whole plants and parts of plants obtained from the use of a protected variety. This kind of PVP system is often the first step towards allowing the full-fledged patenting of life forms. Indeed, In this case, the rest of the law does not rule out the patenting of plants or animals. The term of the monopoly is 20 years for crop varieties and 25 years for trees and vines. During this time, the protected variety de facto becomes the property of the breeder, and nobody can plant or otherwise use this variety without compensating the breeder, the patent holder. This new law means that Iraqi farmers can neither freely, legally plant nor save for replanting seeds of any plant variety which is registered under the plant variety provisions by the new patent law. This deprives farmers what they and many others worldwide claim as their inherent right to save and to replant their own seeds. Now, the new law is presented as being necessary to ensure the supply of good quality seeds in Iraq and to facilitate Iraq's accession to the World Trade Organization. What it will actually do is to facilitate the penetration of Iraqi agriculture by the likes of Monsanto, Syngenta, Bayer, and Dow Chemical, the corporate giants that control seed and seed trade across the entire world. Eliminating competition from farmers is a prerequisite for these companies to keep up operations in Iraq, which the new law has achieved. Taking over the first step in the food chain is their next move. The new patent law also explicitly promotes the commercialization of genetically modified seeds in Iraq, despite serious resistance from farmers and consumers around the world. These same companies are pushing genetically modified crops onto farmers in Iraq and around the world for their own profit. And contrary to what the industry is asserting, genetically modified seeds do not reduce the use of pesticides, but rather they pose a threat to the environment and to people's health while they increase the farmer's dependency on fertilizers and chemical sprays and commercial agribusiness. In some countries, like India, the accidental release of genetically modified crops is deliberately manipulated, since physical segregation of GM and non-GM crops is not feasible. Once introduced into the agroecological cycle, there is no possible recall or cleanup from genetic pollution. As to the WTO argument, Iraq legally has a number of options for complying with the organization's rules on intellectual property, but the United States simply decided that Iraq should not enjoy nor to explore them. Iraq is one more arena in a global drive for the adoption of seed patent laws protecting the monopoly rights of multinational corporations at the expense of local farmers. Over the past decade, many countries of the South have been compelled to adopt seed patent laws through bilateral treaties. The United States has pushed for UPOV-styled plant protection laws beyond the IPR standards of the World Trade Organization in bilateral trade through agreements, for example, with Sri Lanka and Cambodia. Likewise, post-conflict countries have been especially targeted. For instance, as part of its reconstruction package, the United States has recently signed a trade and investment framework, an agreement with Afghanistan, which would also include IPR-related issues. Iraq is a special case in that the adoption of the patent law was not part of negotiations between sovereign countries, nor did a sovereign lawmaking body enact it as reflecting the will of the Iraqi people. In Iraq, the patent law is just one more component in the comprehensive and radical transformation of the occupation and the occupied country's economy along neoliberal lines by the occupying powers. This transformation would entail not just the adoption of favored laws, but also the establishment of institutions that are most conducive to a free market regime. Order number 81 is just one of 100 orders left behind by Bremer, and among the more notable of these laws is the controversial order number 39, which effectively lays down the overall legal framework for Iraq's economy by giving foreign investors rights equal to those rights of Iraqis in exploiting Iraq's domestic market. In this country, we call that free trade. Now, taken together, all of these laws, which cover virtually all aspects of the Iraq economy, including Iraq's trade regime, the mandate of the central bank, regulations on trade union activities, and so on, they lay the basis for the United States and its bigger objective of building a neoliberal regime in Iraq. Order 81 explicitly states that its provisions are consistent with Iraq's transition from a non-transparent, centrally planned economy to a free market economy characterized by sustainable economic growth through the establishment of a dynamic private sector and the need to enact institutional and legal reforms to give it effect. Now, pushing for these reforms in Iraq has been the U.S. Agency for International Development, which has been implementing an agricultural reconstruction and development program for Iraq since October of 2003. To carry it out, a one-year, $5 million contract was granted to the U.S. consulting firm Development Alternatives Incorporated with the Texas A&M University as an implementing partner. Part of the work has been subcontracted to SAGRIC International of Australia. The goal of ARDI, in the name of rebuilding the farming sector, is to develop the agribusiness opportunities and thus provide markets for agricultural products and services from overseas. Reconstruction work, thus, is not necessarily about rebuilding domestic economies and capacities, but rather it's about helping corporations approved by the occupying forces to capitalize on market opportunities in Iraq. The legal framework laid down by Bremer ensures that although U.S. troops may leave Iraq in the conceivable future, U.S. domination of Iraq's economy is here to stay long after American troops depart. Food sovereignty is the right of people to define their own food and agriculture policies, to protect and regulate domestic agricultural production and trade, to decide the way food should be produced, what should be grown locally, and what should be imported and exported. The demand for food sovereignty and the opposition to the patenting of seeds has been central to the small farmer struggle all over the world over the past decade. By fundamentally altering the IPR regime, the United States government has now ensured that Iraq's agricultural system will remain under American occupation in Iraq. Iraq has the potential to feed itself, but instead of developing this capacity, the United States has shaped the future of Iraq's food and farming to serve the interests of United States corporations. The new IPR regime pays scant response or respect to Iraqi's farmers or their contributions to the development of important crops like wheat, barley, dates, and pulses. While political sovereignty remains an illusion, food sovereignty for the Iraqi people has already been made near impossible by these new regulations. Iraq's freedom and sovereignty will remain questionable for as long as Iraqis do not have control over what they sow, what they grow, what they reap, or what they eat. Now, concurrent with that was a story that came out of New York. It was the New Yorker magazine. Let's see if I can find it here. Well, I don't seem to have it right in front of me, but it was a story that dealt with the smuggling now, of raw milk into Manhattan. That's right. The smuggling of raw milk into Manhattan by the Mennonite Mafia from Pennsylvania, if you can believe that story. It seems that somebody in Manhattan decided that they wanted to drink raw milk. So they brought raw milk in, or they bought raw milk from Pennsylvania, and they brought it into New York City. A recent issue of the New Yorker magazine carried an article about a community gardener and herbalist who was in the process of committing a crime. She had arranged for a Mennonite farmer in Pennsylvania to ship raw, unpasteurized, unhomogenized milk and other dairy products to a basement on Manhattan's west side. A small group of raw dairy aficionados were individually contacted and invited to purchase the illegal goods. Why illegal? Well, because only California and Georgia still allow the sale of raw dairy products in stores. Elsewhere, you can only purchase these products directly from local dairy farmers, and while New York City has nearly everything, you won't find a single working dairy farm in Manhattan. But if you know someone who knows someone who knows a certain community gardener, you might be able to pick up a gallon of raw milk that has been illegally transported across state lines and into New York City. We can thank the milk industry for turning consumers into criminals. Over the years, representatives of the industry convinced the public and federal regulators that unpasteurized, unhomogenized raw dairy products pose a serious health risk. Here's corporate America at its best. But HSI panelist Alan Spreen, MD, has a much different view of the situation. The politics of running the certified raw milk dairies out of business is as sickening as the modern milk that we're now forced to drink. It was consistently shown that there were fewer bacteria in raw milk than the pasteurized variety. The problem is, it takes far more care and procedural hassle to pull it off, and the big boys weren't willing to do that. That's why the wonderful certified raw milk from Altadena, Mathis, and other dairies is now a thing of the past. So what's the problem with commercial milk? Well, it has now proven our worst fears, and they have now come to pass. The people of New York, we have always known, are criminal and have a criminal bent, but now the Mennonite Mafia has now exploited that criminal bent and is now smuggling raw milk into the city of New York. My God, what next? Illegal drugs on the street corners? Well, we're about out of time. The opinions, beliefs, the comments, and the views and expressions that you hear on this program, remember, are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or the staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org, or call the Law School at 417-273-4967. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and editorial review. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Well, there's the signal that says my time's up. I gotta leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.